Does everybody know who these people on the shrine are? Erica? You know who Chögyam Trungpa is? And who, what's his name? Oh, no. Sakyong Mipam are. And this is father and son. This one born in Tibet, escaped from Tibet. His son born in India in 1962. And they have both made their way into everybody's consciousness in terms of presenting the Dharma in modern terms, and I will be talking about that tonight. Does everybody know this book, The Shambhala Principle? Let's pass it around so everybody can see it. It's an interesting book in that it it's not exactly a dialogue between father and son, because the father was not there. It's after the father passed away. But it is still a kind of imagined dialogue between father and son, and gives some idea. So part of what I'm going to talk about tonight and ask you to help me with is based on that book, and part of what I'm going to talk about is based on this book. Have you seen this book, Work, Sex, Money? The implication there is that meditation is not about total retreat. I mean, you may have retreat for a couple of weeks sometimes, or 4 days or whatever, but mostly meditation is actually about connecting with the tough issues that we face. Things in the workplace, relationships in general, and money. And there we're facing generosity issues, we're facing time issues, we're facing social issues of disparity and all that. So maybe I'll pass that one around too, so that people can get a look at that. I spoke on, Eric might remember, I spoke in that book about the first month it came out in this group, and, but it was more a book review, which I'm not going to do tonight. It was kind of an idea. Tonight will be, well, what is our topic for tonight? Our topic is meditation and ordinary life. And I'll give away the ending right now, that the idea is that meditation has got to relate to what we do, work, sex, money, and a thousand other things. It's got to work there. It's not really designed to just flourish in a cave or in retreat or in even a container like this one. Maybe the very first thing we could do is examine our deep motivations for meditating, or for coming to meditation. Anybody want to say anything about that? What does bring us to this?
My experience with that is that what brings us here is not why we stay.
Well, I guess I could change the question. What keeps you coming back?
It helps.
It helps. It helps, okay. It helps with something or other.
Yeah.
I remember, I can remember that far back, and being in a very stressed part of my life when I first started meditating. And, you know, I teach an open house sometimes in Boulder where it's new people every week, and they really are, in many cases, right off the street, not having meditated at all. And the kind of, if I asked about motivation, get stress, and my mind is too active, and I want to slow it down, that kind of thing. And one reason to look at our motivation is to see what our expectations of meditation are, and see how our expectations overlap with materialism. So, you know, we think we can get something from meditation. And I'm talking about me, not others too, perhaps. But so often people come in with an expectation of calm abiding. How about that for a fancy phrase? Calm abiding. Or peace. Or a pure realm. Or retreat from struggle. Or let's say retreat from work, sex, money. Retreat from the whole thing. And that is what we call eternalism. So I'm going to got two words coming up here, eternalism and nihilism. And they're considered the sort of twin poles of push and pull. We might be pushed or pulled toward one or toward the other, and we're really looking for a happy medium. So there's a eternalism, meaning we'll be saved. I can find a resting place where I don't have to worry about work, sex, money, or anything. I can find a permanent resting place. And you might call it heaven, or you might call it nirvana, or you might call it getting rich. You might call it a pure realm, but there's an eternal feeling to it, and what comes along with eternal is an eternal protector, a refuge, taking refuge in some more powerful being. And at the opposite pole, nihilism, one may not think that meditation is going to lead to the eternalistic solution, but typically it's very possible anyway to have a sort of hopeless feel about meditation, or hopeless feel about our life, that nothing's going to straighten it out, and that we're stuck with the really hard job of being us. So that's what we're looking for. We're looking for some kind of gap there between those two. And by the way, what I'm talking about here is called samsara. Have you heard that phrase before? Samsara, or Sam and Sarah. Sam and Sarah do their thing. They live in cyclic existence. They're always reliving. There's always, as you patch up one coral, you're laying the seeds for the next. And both eternalism and nihilism as a way of life tend to sow the seeds for further samsara. If we think we're going to be eternally saved, then right there, that's a pretty powerful seed. Because, of course, we're not. The Buddha taught impermanence, that any kind of thing we hope for in the eternal realm is not going to serve. So we may come to, or as we kind of get into it, we can come to meditation with a more focused goal or view of things. We can come with a sort of revulsion. In fact, revulsion in some contexts is said to be one of the pillars of samsara, of liberation, revulsion with samsara. In other words, we're kind of sick of the way we've been doing things, and there is a hope that maybe we could learn something else. And that is what we're talking about tonight, is finding something else, either short-term or long-term, but something else that could be found by kind of taking a middle road here. And by the way, the whole thing plays out very similarly in our outer lives, forgetting about meditation, but still plays out that we're either totally frustrated, or we can be anyway, very frustrated with the way things are going in life, or we can be in the eternal trip. We can foster the mistaken belief that we've figured out how to make this life work, and we can make it work forever. I know how to get a job because I got a job and I got just the right family. And so again, going with the teachings of the Buddha, we've got to find some way to steer away from that eternalist belief without crashing into the more nihilistic belief. Does someone want to say, what was the first noble truth? Would you like to say that, Eric?
Yeah, suffering.
Suffering. And what about suffering?
It seems to be all over the place in life.
Seems to be all over the place in life. Okay, that was the bad news. And what was the second noble truth?
The Buddha said there's a cause. But is that the second one?
Yes, sir. What is the cause?
Yeah. Ego.
Ego.
Attachment to ego.
Attachment to things, yes. Yeah. So that, you know, even attachment to nirvana could be part of the problem. So anyway, life is confused, bewildering, and frustrating. But we begin to be challenged in our materialism. So you could say the revulsion is toward materialism. And our inclination may therefore be to reject materialism outright. So that means we create, or it's possible for us to create, I don't mean to say anybody here is doing this, but it's been known to happen, we come to create an idealized spirituality where spirituality is taken as meaning a rejection of materialism, a rejection of samsara. And now you can reject materialism at a lot of levels, but you know, if you suddenly decide that you've got to be in a cave and drink nothing but nettle soup and withdraw from humanity. I think the point of this book is that that's a mistake. That's taking it too far. And that the world we live in is not actually the problem. And this idealized spirituality contains some idea of sacredness. Like when I'm in front of my altar and bowing before this picture and lighting incense and chanting the names or whatever the name of that creature in the middle is. If I'm doing all of that, then I think, oh yes, I'm spiritual today. This is sacred. And that again is just working into some kind of materialism. And in fact, the message that Trungpa Rinpoche, man on the left here, the message that he gave over and again was that everything's sacred. That all our struggles contain sacredness. All our beauty, even things we might consider ugly, contain a sacred quality, and the sacred quality is partly due to the wonder of our mind being able to be cognizant of everything. It's just that feeling of being alive contains the sacredness of everything. Anybody want to say anything about this? Does that sound too far-fetched? Or?
I'm thinking about how people can use materialism as being materialistic about the meditation. Like it's a possession. Something like learning how to play chess. You learn how to meditate.
Yeah.
And then that's something that you own. You know? And see how that works out. If you take that kind of view to it.
I should say, in fact, what's written for me to say next is that that in this book and also in somewhere near the start of Myth of Freedom, he talks about three kinds of materialism. Remember that?
Three parts of materialism.
The three, yes, sometimes personified as the three lords of materialism. And they are physical, psychological, and the third one is spiritual materialism. And physical materialism has to do with collection of things, desire for things, maybe situations too. Like you want a front row seat for something. Boosting to ego. And then psychological materialism, well, would include being good at chess. Yeah, oh, I've got that. I own these guys because I can beat all of them, yeah. Or it could be tennis, or it could be anything, but there's a kind of one-upmanship that can be found as psychological materialism. And, you know, both of these are feeding into samsara, feeding into the cause of suffering, as Eric said, the cause of suffering being the grasping after material things. And then the third one, the spiritual materialism, could involve ownership, and it could include things like, oh, I'm so holy myself, I'm going to polish my medals. You know, and I was taught how to do this practice that not everybody gets. And I was, I get to teach a class. Really great. You know, the spiritual materialism is lurking just everywhere. Or, oh, they let me light the candles yesterday. I'm not making it up. This kind of thing happens. And again, I think what Trungpa wanted to emphasize, and it certainly shows up also in the writings of Sakyamunipam, was that the material objects are not the problem. That, for instance, having a nice car, well, that's great, you know. Maybe you can do something useful with that car. Or knowing how to play chess. That's not a problem. In fact, there's not somebody out there that wants an opponent that's a good player. So there you are. You could do that. And, you know, whatever you've done to crank up some spiritual materialism, well, again, that's got some value. If you've learned a lot of things, you can help others with them. If you just light the candle, that's good too. Everybody knows. So, and that's really how to kind of defang those lords of materialism. For psychological, we like the ego boost of somebody praising us rather than blaming us. But, you know, praise and blame, they have some place in society in terms of feedback and making things work right. And in the religious realm again, a lot of what we're looking for on all of these is confirmation. We want something or other to tell us we're okay. Either God in heaven or our friends or our chess partner or, you know, whatever. Or our car. What could tell us we're really a great person? I'm giving kind of cartoon versions of these things, but, you know, the cartoons have some kind of truth in them as well. Anyone want to say anything more about materialism?
Well, it's the basic principle of advertising.
Yeah.
That there's something wrong, that it can be fixed by the product, and by acquiring this product or are going to a certain school or what have you, whatever advertising is floating about, that are making you feel worse so that you notice that you have a lack in some way that can be filled with this item.
Well, here's an interesting question then. How about meditation? Does it give us some kind of immunity to that advertising? Have you noticed that?
Well, I would say that I have an Apple phone, an iPad, and a Mac. So, I would say that I recognize that they have sold me a bill of goods. And it works for what I want. But I'm not sure that it makes my life that much easier. It breaks down. You have to learn things that you don't know. And you have to go along with their system.
Yep.
So, this is pretty pervasive in our society.
I'd like to say, the thing about materialism is that it's easy to be blind to your own areas.
It's very hard for us to see our own.
Yeah, like you just don't realize that, well, of course, I'm just that way. Whereas, in fact, you are actually richly engaged with all this materialist stuff without knowing it. Yeah. So, that's why, like, Jesus said the thing about the log in your own eye.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like that.
Yeah, it's easy to see those materialistic logs. And of course, the ultimate thing in spiritual material is, I am going to be enlightened.
Yeah. Wait, go for it.
Well, you know, we have to go for it even so. That's the really interesting thing, is that we, you know, realize that this is a sort of a problem or a pitfall, but we have to work with what we have too. So,
I think meditation develops your sense of humor.
Yeah,
and that really helps.
Well, I like to think that the experience of meditation is really introducing yourself to your own wisdom. That actually, when we meditate, we become available to ourselves in a way that, without it, we tend to miss the very nature of who we are and what we do, because we react out of habit.
Yeah.
And that numbs us.
Yeah.
So from that point of view, then the meditation is really coming home, in a way, to make your full life energy available without segmenting or pushing away some aspect of your being that you don't want to deal with when you actually. There's nothing, everything we do that doesn't relax with who we are, we know that the joke's on us because we know that we're making that effort. Because as soon as we make the effort to push something away that's unpleasant, if someone reminds us, we get angry. And we don't want to be exposed to our own game.
Yep.
And so the kindest thing we can do, then, if we really understand what meditation is about being able to be with ourselves and have kindness to ourselves.
Be with ourselves and have kindness to ourselves.
Did I come out of the wrong part of your?
No, you're doing great. And anybody else want to make a comment here?
I have a comment on spiritual, but maybe it's more than that. It's more on what this path does. There's all these obstacles, like the spiritual materialism. And my experience with these things is that the path takes care of these things for you.
Yeah.
That I can remember the first time I lit incense at a Shambhala training level, I was thinking, wow. And I shook it, and it broke. it just blew it all away.
Yeah.
And but things like that are not at all uncommon. That you know, when you're taking something too seriously, something will blow a hole in it.
There's a lot of...
I think the thing with this path is you notice it, I think things like that happen all the time in your life anyway, but most of the time you don't notice it. But once you start practicing, you see it.
I'll read one little section from this book. This will be on page 28 or 29. Living in a cave in the mountains amid the beauties of nature and fresh air, meditation will come naturally because there will be no disturbances. Everything will be quiet. Silence will reign. There will be no one to irritate you because you've left the nasty associations of your past history. You've forgotten your past. You've given it up. You don't care who you were. You think you only care who you are now. Live in the mountains. Enjoy nature, fresh air, fantastic vibrations, blah, blah, blah. There is something uncertain about this whole vision. There may be some wisdom in it, but it has been said that it's not only wisdom that's important, but also compassion. If we take the need for compassion into account, the scenario above doesn't completely address the problem. It is in connection with compassion that the difference between the materialistic approach to spirituality and the natural, genuine quality of spirituality begins to break through. The spiritual approach without spiritual materialism is based on compassion. Compassion tells you that finally you have to return to the world. Not only just finally, but the whole time you have to work with the world. Relate with the world, because enlightened mind contains wisdom and compassion simultaneously. You have an obligation to the world you were brought up in. This is the world you belong to. You can't give it up altogether. You can't dissociate yourself from the past or whatever irritates you. In fact, compassion brings us back to dealing with the world as the only way. We have to work with people. We have to work with our fathers, mothers, sisters and brothers, our neighbors and friends. We have to do that because the people with whom we are associated in our lives provide the only situation that drives us to the spiritual search. They provide irritations, negativities and demands. They provide us with everything.
The other problem is the Sankhan keeps telling us correctly that wherever you go to sit and meditate, you bring your world with you.
Yeah. And I just want to notice here that say a little bit about how Chogyam Trungpa taught. He had dozens of ways to make people interact with their world. Well, when he was first in Boulder, he told people, yeah, you should go to medical school, or you should go to dental school, and forget about being a monk or nun or whatever. Actually bring out your riches, and that's part of the way we, you know, have a better community. And then he had a lot of programs, and his followers have a lot of programs at camps away from town, like the Shambhala Mountain Center, and where you're going to go. Those programs contain what we call rota, which means work period. And that was, it's not just we have to round up some people because the dishes need washing, but it's more of we need to have a community here. We need to have that very thing that he was just talking here, where we meet irritation and we meet kindness, and we see what our own take on that is. We see how we're bringing that to the first noble truth, actually. He invented an army when he first got here. We have the army whose motto is victory over war, and they wear uniforms. Have you seen them? Erica?
I actually got to see Crazy Wisdom with Dale Asser.
Ah, so there's some of that in there.
I don't remember the guy's name. But they shared stories about their time as students of his, and then watched the movie and like getting to hear them laugh and titter at different things in the movie. But anyway, the marching.
Yeah. So it was, that was all done there. Again, well, there's a sort of outer purpose, which is the crowd management and protection of the teachers and whatnot, but I think there's an inner purpose there also of really being in a society, a small society. That, and if you ever get an opportunity, try signing up for it. You can sign up for a short campaign or longer.
Part of it too is just the historical context, because this was happening by the time of Vietnam and everything. So a lot of the young people just could not stand the idea of getting into a uniform. And like he was just throwing that right, into their...
Was that part of it? Like, because that was such a hot topic?
I don't know, but I suspect so.
Yeah, I think so too, yeah.
Yeah.
It's trying to tame the whole idea of aggression. Mm-hmm. And but he said that the training for the CASA, they call it the military arm, but it's essentially public safety. I mean, some communities call their police public safety officers. And people who dress in the custom garb in dealing with their aggression, I mean, one of the slogans is like willing to be a fool.
Not afraid to be a fool.
Not afraid to be a fool. Not to be so stiff.
And I want to mention one phrase that was, when I first was in this group in the early to mid 80s, one often heard the phrase householder yogin. Yogin here meaning meditator or follower of a path. And householder not meaning you had to own a house exactly, but your life was not monastic, but you had a household. Children, parents, whatever, dogs, whatever's there, and that you actually make this part of your practice. That you're not rejecting anything. And so that means that practice becomes a round-the-clock endeavor. We have this strange phrase, post-meditation. And what does post-meditation really mean? It means the whole rest of your life. I mean, you might be looking for some kind of immediate post-meditative glow, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about carrying the teachings into daily life, which makes the whole thing very, very rich. It's like every moment we have this opportunity to practice. Practice what? Compassion. Or simpler, just practice mindfulness or awareness. Be a little bit aware of what's happening. Do you want to say anything? You said anything?
I
I should have, but I think I'm just slow this week. Been on the road.
Okay.
But I'll think about it. Thank you for that asking me.
And how about you, Joe? Would you like to say anything?
I'm good.
Okay. And the final, just couple of words I want to say is, we come to the writings of Sakyong Mipham and all of his talkings, and don't forget about Sakyong.com, and Mipham.com also exists. So he's talking so much about society. Now, the days we have one practice where we actually chant that society is basically good. And so the idea is to find some focus of goodness, some way to see goodness beyond some kind of inner circle. I mean, we could sit around here and say, oh yeah, you're basically good, I'm basically good. We could ring the changes on that, but you know, do we really think what's happening in society has some goodness to it, or potential goodness? I remember, I don't know if any of you were here when I came, the last time I was here was 2 days after the election. Remember that? And actually we canceled the talk that I had and we just discussed what life was like after the election. And, well, it hasn't gotten a whole lot better, but I'm sleeping better now, but maybe I hope you are too, but still, we, you know, got a lot to face. And it's really all of a piece that I've been talking about tonight, the idea of not rejecting anything. Began, and you know, that even begins in our meditation instruction, which says, well, okay, you had a thought, it's okay, you don't have to push it away particularly, you don't have to judge it or evaluate it, just be with it. And that openness toward thoughts, then openness toward others, some kind of compassion coming in, and finally openness to the whole society and willingness to work with it. So I think I'll stop there. There's 5 minutes left if anyone wants to say anything.
Well, maybe it's developing an attitude of openness, because it's obviously that there are situations in our lives, especially in politics, that you don't necessarily feel compassion and kindness toward, but don't add to it. Don't make the situation worse. You know, at least if you have some kind of compassion within yourself and can extend out, then you're not responsible for that situation, but at least you can allow it some space.
Allow some space, yeah. That was something that Trump by himself liked to say a lot, would allow some space.
It's interesting, too, because Gary and I recently had an experience where we didn't have much physical space, and it really did affect the mind when you get into a very cramped...
But like an airplane, or what?
Well, it was actually our son's spare everything room. The room was everything, the study, the paper storage, you know, and it for 2 weeks was the mattress on the floor.
And about 6 inches of walking space around.
Around wow. It. And
no walking meditation for
no.
you.
No.
But it really did affect the mind.
Yeah.
And kept working on it. And you could leave it. I mean, obviously, we weren't locked into the room, but it's a challenge to see. So maybe That's what I appreciate in the space here. I think you worked so hard on it. You really made it feel very open and spacious and welcoming. So I think if one wants to work on the mind, you know, that it's good to put oneself in a place where, unless you really can't, you know, the atmosphere also allows you to develop that quality.
Yeah, well, that's very important. Thank you for saying that. The whole idea of householder yoga back then did include some ideas that maybe a little more space, or uncluttered anyway, would really allow that meditative space to be there round the clock instead of... And then, of course, the shrine rooms were all... The meditation halls were all designed with the idea of not a cluttered beauty exactly, but more of a spacious, open, like you say, open thing. Yeah.
I noticed that with speech. I don't know if it's in certain cultures, but if you'll encounter a person and that person will start to ask you question after question after question. I don't know if they're putting you in the box or that's just that person's capacity for having a non-conversation. And my mental space starts to back up.
Yeah.
And then, I don't know, this happened, I guess it was Saturday night, and I had to sort of tongue in it, I guess, you know, which means I had to kind of say, okay, I'm going to take in this person's 9,000 questions, and at some point I'm just going to let it drop. And try to see that they're still basically a good person, but yeah, it started to get kind of claustrophobic. Like, I don't want to answer one more question, you know. So I don't know what that is. I mean, I see there's possession materialism, and there's, I don't know, there's some people, I don't know what kind of materialism.
Speech.
Is it speech materialism?
Yeah, I guess you could call it that. Yeah.
Well, it depends if that person was just trying, they were nervous and are just needed to fill in the space and dominate, or they were trying to use the speech to recognize they had some special quality over other people.
It's interesting about speech. Trungpa Rinpoche issued something at one point called the mindfulness of speech practice.
Yeah.
And I don't have it memorized. One edict was leave space between your thoughts and listen carefully, a number of other things like that. Remember any more of it?
No, but I do tell kids that. I say, you have thought, get it all together, because I work with children, and then I say, and then you have speech, and laugh. You know, they don't realize it's not the same thing.
Right.
We don't teach that. It's a shame we don't teach that at a young age.
I found, over 30 years I've been meditating, I found that my speech did change.
Mm-hmm.
Slower. No more cuss words, and just a little bit more respectful. Yeah, and no, I'm not particularly trying for that. But, and I think you meet others in meditating for a while, you will notice that, I think.
Yeah. You know, when you were talking about eternalism, it hit me that we live in a really weird society. There's so many stories that end with they lived happily ever after.
Oh, that's, yeah.
You know,
exactly.
That's eternalism right there.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, that's
they,
in
you
a nutshell.
Know,
that's
they
it.
Lived happily ever after for the next 2 weeks. You know?
Did I promise 9 o'clock? Okay.